News now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Dr. Jim Russ.
I just gave myself an honorary doctorate.
Yeah,
yes,
exactly.
Indeed. Well, we had an eventful week. The January 1st, of course, the internet was 30 years old.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, we'll go back and sort of replay some of the events that happened when they created the internet. This is not the ARPANET. This is the internet when mm-hmm. they actually standardized on the current protocol, TCP/IP, and they did the official switch over to TCP/IP January 1st, 1982. 30 years ago.
30 years. I had no idea they did it.
30 years ago, yeah. And we'll talk about sort of the trials and tribulations that they had there. We're going to feature this morning the man behind the scan code that you use when you check out your groceries.
Oh, really?
You know, the guy who actually wrote the patent for the scan code.
No kidding.
And how that developed and when the patent was done. It's quite an interesting story how he was sitting on the beach when he came up with the idea. Down in Florida, we have an idea of the week. It's a gravity-powered light. It's a light for like developing countries that they don't need batteries, you don't need kerosene, and it will operate for 30 minutes, just sort of like a clock. Mm-hmm. It's quite a good idea. And then we'll review the top jobs for 2013. And again, it was a huge mailbag. Yes.
Oh, wait a minute.
Mr. Big Voice, would you go back and get some more Jolt?
He had
let him back in. Okay,
copy in front of him.
That's
so
right.
Just gave him the right cue card.
Listen, he only has two lines.
That's right.
There's a letter in your mail.
Okay,
there you go.
All right, come
on.
He's got two lines, and he gets them mixed up. You know, what do you say?
I don't know.
I think he's mad because he didn't get a pay increase.
Maybe we should find a Mrs. Big Voice.
Oh, yeah. That would be good.
That would
fix
him.
The voice behind the voice.
No, a voice to replace the voice.
The voice to replace the voice. We got an email from Margaret. Dear Dr. Schertz, I got the following email today and don't understand its meaning. I've never used this email address that they reference for my Apple account. Do you think it's spam? Thanks, Margaret. This is what the email said. Hello. The following information for your Apple ID was updated December 21st, and we need to know your security questions and answers that go with this so we can verify your website.
Oh, boy.
If these changes were made in error, if you believe an unauthorized person changed anything, please log on to this website, enter your Apple ID and password, and then go to this website and provide your challenge question. Thank you. Apple support. We care for our customers.
Sure.
Margaret, this was definitely a phishing attempt. They want you to go to their website and provide your Apple ID, password, and challenge questions. Then they'll take over your account.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's tied to a credit card, they'll probably start buying stuff. Most notifications of account changes advise you to make a phone call, not to go online. And so one thing that I never do is I never use a link which is in an email because you don't know where it's going to go. If I want to verify my account, I actually type in the address directly and never use the specific link. But this type of email goes out. Like you might have online banking. I get all kinds of online banking things where they want to steal your bank account. Mm-hmm. So you were wise indeed, Margaret, not to fall for this phishing. And this is P-H-I-S-H-I, phishing attempt, as they say. We got an email from Lola.
Ooh.
Yeah. Dear Doc Schertz.
That's awfully familiar.
Yeah. Well, you know, Lola. she calls me Doc.
First name basis.
Yeah, that's right. Happy holidays and hope 2013 is stellar. I ordered a new iMac, and it's due to arrive today. Currently, I'm using Windows Live Mail and have about 10 accounts. Gmail, Hotmail, Verizon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Pouring through this conduit. I get a ton of spam through my Verizon account, even though I've set up spam filtering. Will the filtering of spam be more effective or powerful in the iMac environment? Should I experience a drop-off in spam? And does it make sense for me to create a new email account with Apple and just start with a clean slate, since the jerks who are sending me spam now have my Verizon address? Thanks, Lola. When you get your new iMac, you'll be able to use OS X Mail. OS X Mail, which of course is Apple's equivalent of Windows Live Mail. And that's basically a consolidator. You can basically have all your email accounts pour into OS X Mail. So you've got one mail account and it goes out to all your different IMAP accounts or POP accounts, pulls in the data, and organizes your email in folders however you want to do it. And OS X Mail is quite a nice program. And it supports multiple protocols, POP, iMac, Exchange, and iCloud accounts. It has mail filters, so you can filter things and put them in specific email accounts. And it has a very, very effective spam filter. The spam filter is what they call a Bayesian spam filter, which means you train it. So as soon as you start getting the spam in your new OS X Mail account, go through all your emails, and if it's spam, declare it to be spam. So you train the filter of what is spam, mm-hmm. and then you go to the spam folder, and if you find anything that's not spam, say not spam. And if you do training on your spam and not spam for a couple of weeks, you'll train your Bayesian filter. And if you go through that training process, this spam filter in the OS X Mail is excellent. Now, if you still get too much spam from your Verizon account, I mean, Verizon allows you to create a new alias. I would just delete that account. I would just create a new alias on your Verizon account. And what I suspect you did is you probably used that particular address in blogs that were on the internet, or you might have entered contests on the internet, and you sort of had that particular email account susceptible to all kinds of spam. And so what you could do is you could send out two or three notices to your friends and contacts that you will have a new email account. You should set up the new email account. You could do it with Verizon. Set up the new email account and give them a couple of notices that you're switching over. Have them switch over your contact information to the new email account. And then just after everybody switched over, just close out your old one. And then just be very careful about entering in contests. In fact, you may want to create a special account that you use just for entering in contests, and you figure that account's going to get eaten with spam, and you don't use it for anything except spam-like activity. But that was a very good question, and many people do have this spam problem. We got an email from Alex. Dear Tech Talk, I'm writing a manual for my users and would like to insert a screenshot into my Windows document. What do you suggest? Thanks, Alex. Well, a screenshot, Alex, as you know, I'm just going to review for our customers.
Sure.
Or a screen capture is a way to take a picture of your computer screen. Windows Vista and Windows 7 includes what they call a snipping tool for just this purpose. You'll find it on the Start menu or under All Programs Accessories. As soon as you run the snipping tool, your screen dims. And then you can click and hold and drag your mouse around to highlight a rectangle on the screen that you would like captured. As soon as you release the mouse, the snipping tool opens with the region that you've selected as an image. Once you've done this, you can click on the icon, the disk icon, or you can type Control S to save the image in a common image format such as JPEG or PNG. The Windows 7 snipping tool is also available in Windows 8. The new Windows 8 tile desktop, to get it on Windows 8, simply start by typing snip under the start menu, and then the snipping tool will come up. Now, you could also do print screen, PRT screen, and the image of your entire screen is placed in your clipboard. So now, rather than printing it, you can do something else with print screen. you can basically take your clipboard and then you can insert it into a document. So sometimes you may want to use an image editor. So what you may want to do is that, you know, once you save the image either as a JPEG or a PNG, you can bring it up to an image editor, or directly from the print screen you could paste it into a blank screen on your image editor, and then you could use the image editor like Paint, and then you could add different writing to it, and then you could save it as a new document. But it's very easily done now in the new Windows version. Great question. We got an email from Alicia. Dear Doc and Jim, if I have an ebook on my computer in the EPUB format and I send it to a friend's computer, can they then send it to their Kindle via a USB cable and then read the book? Love the show, Alicia. Well, Alicia, actually, you can transfer it to the Kindle via USB. You could send it to your friend, and they could upload it to the Kindle. The problem is the Kindle won't read it. Kindle does not read the open-source EPUB format because Kindle has a proprietary format for their ebooks. And so you have to basically convert the EPUB to the Kindle, to the Amazon proprietary format. The good news is there's a program called Calibre, mm-hmm. Calibre. It's an ebook program that also has the ability to save the ebook as in different formats. You can use it for ebook conversion. It's a good desktop reader, and you can convert it to all the standard formats for all of the book readers. In the case of the Amazon Kindle, they're using the MOBI format, M-O-B-I format. Now, they put on top of the MOBI format a digital rights management layer, a DRM layer on top of the MOBI format, but which you probably won't have in your EPUB. But that's all right. The Kindle's going to read the MOBI. So all you have to do is bring up the ebook in Calibre and then save as the ebook, and select the MOBI format, and then you can upload that to the Kindle reader, and you'll have no problem. Now, Calibre is an interesting program. It's free. Calibre is an open-source project that was started by David Goyal while he was still in graduate school, because he got tired of having to have all these specialized ebook formats, and he kept it adding to it, and he made it an open-source project, so many people are contributing to it now. And you can download Calibre free of charge from calibre-ebook.com. It supports Windows 32-bit and 64-bit machines, Linux, and OS X. Program is shareware, and they would like you to support it if you find it useful, but you don't actually have to. Now, my practice is I'll download shareware. I'll use it a bit. And I won't pay for it at first, but if I find that the program is truly useful and I'm using it on an ongoing basis, I go back to the shareware site to make a contribution. That's the beauty of shareware. You only pay if it's useful. So it's really a great concept. Just make certain to close the loop and pay when it is useful, and then you'll have more shareware. We got an email from Susan. Dear Dr. Schertz, I'm being transferred to India for the next 6 months. Yeah, I hope this isn't somebody from Stratford.
You would know about it, you would think.
I would pretty much know about it, yeah. We're not transferring anybody to our Indian campus, New Delhi campus. I would like to find a way for my friends in the U.S. to call me without a hassle. What do you suggest? Thanks, Susan in Alexandria. Well, the good news, Susan, you've got several options using voice over IP over the Internet. I'll give you a few. One, if you have Skype, you could buy a Skype phone number. You could get a U.S. phone number, which is local for your friends. It'll cost you about $60 a year. And then what happens, they call that phone number. It's forwarded directly to your Skype account. So if you've got a Skype account open on your PC in India, your desktop will ring whenever they call your number. And you could get a Skype voicemail account. And if you're not online, they could leave a voicemail. And as far as your friends are concerned, it's simply a local call. You can do the same thing with Google Voice. Google Voice has also voice numbers that you can get. Now, the last time I checked with Google Voice, the phone numbers were free. I had a free Google Voice number, but I didn't use it, so now I don't have it anymore.
I had the same problem. I had one, and it expired.
Mm-hmm. So I haven't been back, but I think they're probably still free. That's the same thing. They can call your Google Voice number, and then you can talk to them over Google Voice. Now, some people get a Vonage account. Vonage is like a box at home. It's a voice over IP box, and you plug your phone system into it. You got one port you plug your phone system into it at home, and the other port you plug in the internet. And then you have a phone number assigned to your Vonage account, and somebody calls you, it just comes over your internet connection and your home phone rings. The nice thing with the Vonage box is that you take the Vonage box to India and plug it into your internet in India. Somebody calls that phone number, your phone rings over in India as a local call. So you can carry the Vonage box with you wherever you want. Now, the downside of Vonage, it's $9.95 per month, which, it's $120 a year. Now, or you could go with Uma. Uma's also has a voice over IP box. Now, you can buy an Uma box for around $200, $210, and then you don't pay a monthly fee. So I have Uma at home. I paid, when I bought mine, it was $225, and then I then assigned my landline number to Uma. So if anybody calls my old landline number, my Uma box lights up, and my home phone rings. The people who are calling me don't even know that I don't have a landline anymore. It's just coming through the internet. So I don't have a landline, but it looks like I do. Now, if I take my Uma box to India, my landline number would ring in India. So that's probably a pretty good option for you, too. Now, the nice thing with Uma, you pay $225. You don't have this monthly charge like you do with Vonage. Mm-hmm. But recently, they required that you have to pay the annual taxes because the government said, wait a minute here, we're losing out on taxes. Mm-hmm. So now you got to pay something like $4.95 per year for telecom taxes, which I just do. The nice thing with Uma too, it gives you free voice over IP calls to any U.S. numbers. So I actually think when you're in India, you could call then your U.S. all your U.S. phone numbers from your Uma box, and it would be a free call from India back over voice over IP. Now, the issue with all of these voice over IP solutions is you need the bandwidth.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems is you go to these other countries, the bandwidth is always not that good, and you especially need good upload bandwidth. It's because you're basically sending voice as an upload. So make certain that you've got sufficient bandwidth and to support this. And so you're going to want to get broadband, and in particular you're going to look at the upload speed on the broadband for your voice over IP. But that was a great question, and actually we do use voice over IP for all of our Indian campuses there, so we don't have to call on these exorbitant phone lines.
Yeah. I have a couple questions about, we got a second here. We were talking about spam earlier. Now, you and I both use Google. Google really does have the best spam filter.
Google Gmail's got a great spam filter. It's also Bayesian, and so you can train it.
Yeah, exactly. That's the other great thing. Now, when you get, suppose like me, you've got one email address, because frankly, I can't handle more than that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You get a bunch of spam.
Mm-hmm.
How can you get the senders of the spam to stop? I mean, there are some things that they give you an unsubscribe feature, but once you got it, you got it.
I think when you unsubscribe, you simply validate that it's a good email address. So, in fact...
That's a good point, Doc.
In fact, if these are unscrupulous scammers, they love you to unsubscribe because then they know it's a real email address. And so that only works if you have the scrupulous spammers, which... That may be an oxymoron.
I was going to say exactly right.
That may be an oxymoron. So it's probably what many people do actually is you can actually create a sub account for your Gmail account. Like you've got something, and then you could put suppose you've got sable@gmail.com would be your account. So you might say. And then so you might, when you go to someplace, you might put sable.alex. at gmail.com. And it turns out that, Gmail just ignores that dot Alex.
Right. We talked about that.
And
before.
So
yeah.
And so then what you do is whenever you go to something that could generate spam, you use the sable@dot Alex, and then you set a filter up in Gmail that all the Alex stuff goes to a subdirectory.
Ah.
And so that you can actually create an email account, you know, like what appears to be a separate email account within the same email account. But the other reason that Google spam filtering is so good, it's crowdsourced.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do, what Google does, because typically when you send out spam, of course, it goes to thousands of people. So what Google does, they actually consolidate all of those messages. And if a particular email is crowdsourced to be declared as spam by, say, 100 people, bingo, it's spam. So a lot of times, by the time it hits your email box, 100 people have already declared it spam, so it goes straight into the spam folder for you. That's why it's so good, the crowdsourcing. So the crowdsourcing is used to edit the Bayesian filter, and that's very good. Whereas the OS X mail is not crowdsourced; it's just you.
Right.
So you've got to train it. You've got to go in and train it. What's spam? What's not spam? And if you don't do proper training, that Bayesian filter doesn't work. With Gmail, because of the crowdsourcing, you don't have to train their Bayesian filter. The crowd trains it.
The only problem I have with Gmail and spam is sometimes if I get something from somebody new that I want, sometimes that will wind up in the spam filter, and then I have to untrain it and say, okay, that's an okay email. That can go to the regular in bin.
It can.
But that's the only I love their spam filter.
I got so much spam in my spam folder, I don't even look at it anymore.
Me neither.
I just delete it.
I kind of go in every so often and see if there's something in there that I missed. And other than that, it's just let it pile up.
That's
all right. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Doc.
Oh, just a minute. We also,
I was going to say, now you tell us, first of all, how would people send you an email if they got a question?
We love your email. Send your emails to techtalk@stratford.edu, and we'll get right back to you.
Okay.
The second thing is, I am monitoring our Facebook page, our Tech Talk Facebook page. And so simply go to facebook.com/techtalkonline and post any comments, and we'll discuss them on the show, or else I'll get back to you at a later week.
Fantastic. This is Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. Profiles in IT is next. Stay with us here on Tech Talk.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for...
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Wait a minute.
Okay, Mr. Big Voice. You know, we're going to have to consider whether we're going to have to bring in Mrs. Mr. Big Voice. You've only got two lines. Okay. All right.
Sometimes
better.
I do this just for comedy effects. Because I get confused.
Oh, he wants to be a comedian. maybe he wants to have another line here on the show.
The third line. Yeah. He can't get the two he's got straight.
That's right. Today we're going to talk about Norman Joseph Woodland. You familiar with Norman Joseph Woodland? Well, that's what his mom called him.
You gave me a tip earlier as to what
that's
he did.
Right.
So, but I'm not going to blow.
Best known as the co-inventor of the barcode used for tracking inventory. Norman Joseph Woodland was born in Atlantic City on September 6, 1921. As a Boy Scout, he learned the Morse code.
And we've talked about Samuel Morse on the show
before.
Yeah,
that's right. He learned the Morse code, which, of course, is a way to convert letters to dots and dashes, like dot, dot, dot is S.
I'm glad you
dash,
know
dash,
do you
dash
know Morse
is
code?
O. Yeah, yeah. SOS is dot, 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 dash, 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 dot, dot, dot. That's SOS.
Were you ever an amateur radio guy?
I was. I had aspirations.
Did you really?
Yeah,
when you were a kid?
I was actually taking the test for amateur radio.
No
but,
kidding.
Yeah.
Why did you stop?
I don't know. I moved on to computers. You know,
something where there's a future.
That's right. After World War II, during World War II, he worked on the Manhattan Project at Oak Ridge as a technician. And after he completed his work on the Manhattan Project in Oak Ridge, Woodland resumed his studies. This was between high school and college. He resumed his studies at the Drexel Institute of Technology, which is now called Drexel University, and he earned a Bachelor of Science degree in 1947. Now, as an undergraduate, Mr. Woodward, by the way, his degree was in mechanical engineering. He perfected a system for delivering elevator music efficiently.
What?
I mean, back this is 1947. This was before we had all the digital MP3s.
Is this
and everything.
The subcarrier on the FM band? Is that what he worked
no,
on?
No, he recorded 15 tracks on 35 millimeter film.
No kidding.
So basically,
video film.
Because 35 millimeter film had, of course, a soundtrack.
Yeah.
So instead of having the picture, he made 15 soundtracks on the film. So they were running 15 parallel soundtracks as he would run through the film, and then you could just switch from track to track for the elevator music.
So would you play this on a conventional player, or
it would be like a special like a special projector that would actually read the soundtracks?
Amazing that people would go to such great lengths
and this
hear
turned
such
out
awful
to
music.
Be extremely simplified over what they were using.
No kidding.
Back then, because you see, before then, of course, they'd have magnetic tape.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have to have 15. If you want to switch between, you'd have to have 15 tape
different
recorders.
Reels.
It was like more, so. This was much simpler. Because
sure.
they had all tracks running simultaneously in one device.
Okay.
So it was like kind of a breakthrough. So he wanted to pursue this project commercially, but his father stepped in and stopped him. His father said, elevator music is controlled by the mob.
What? You're kidding
this me. 1947. Apparently, the mob controlled elevators in Atlantic City. So he said, son, I'm not going to let you get into elevator music because that's controlled by the mob.
You never know what you're going to learn on the show. That's amazing.
So he went back to school. What else do you do when your dreams are crushed? He went back to school to work on a master's degree.
That's not true. A lot of our guys drop out of school when their dreams are crushed.
He went back to school and then he dropped out. See, because so we still have a dropout story here. So he went back to school to work on his master's degree at Drexel, and while he was working on his master's degree in 1948, a supermarket executive came in and talked to the dean of the school, and asked him to develop an efficient means for encoding product data. Well, the dean looked at this project. He says, this is really too mundane for us, and he turned down the project. But that request was overheard by Norman's friend, Bernard Silver. And Bernard came home that night. He says, you know what? I heard something the dean talking about today, and blah, blah, blah. And Woodland said, he says, hey, that's a good idea. Maybe we should work on that. So then Woodland started thinking about it. And they came up with a scheme with ultraviolet light, trying to come up with a product code. That didn't really work out well. Well, Woodland was convinced that a solution was close and that he could make millions in this. And the good thing is, supermarkets apparently were not controlled by the mob.
That's a good thing.
So then what he did, he dropped out of school, because there's always a dropout here, Jim. He dropped out of graduate school, and he... so he could devote himself to the problem. And he used earnings that he'd gotten from the stock market to sort of fund himself while he was doing this. He moved down to Florida and lived in his grandparents' home on Miami Beach. And he spent the summer of 1948-49 thinking on the beach. This is what he told his dad. He said, Dad.
I'll bet there was some drinking on the beach, too.
Was that a typo? No, it's thinking. It's thinking on the beach, Jim. Not drinking on the beach. Thinking on the beach. So he was down there thinking on the beach.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm mistaken.
Yeah.
Terribly sorry.
And so he recalled, as he was thinking about this supermarket code thing, he recalled the Morse code that he'd learned as a Boy Scout.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, you have dots and dashes,
right.
Dots and dashes. So what he did while he was sitting on the beach, he put down dots and dashes. Maybe we could use dots and dashes on a code. And then he took a dot and he made a thin line. He took his finger in the sand and he made a thin line.
Hmm.
And then a dash, he put down two fingers and made a thick line.
Uh-huh.
And so in the sand, he made the first barcode as he was dreaming about the problem. And so he invented the barcode idea in the sand, thinking on the beach in Miami. And you could actually have a linear barcode where you encode, say, Morse code in these bars. Or he thought, but because you don't know about the orientation of the groceries, he actually took the lines and made them circles, and he made them like a bullseye,
mm-hmm.
where the rings on the bullseye were variable spaced, either thin or thick. So then he had a bullseye scan device. So he had both a linear and a bullseye design that he came up with on the beach. And I've got pictures of his first design. I don't have them here in our notes, but it was pretty interesting. And so he went back and he talked to his buddy, who had overheard the conversation, and they decided to patent this idea because they said, "Wow, this is really hot." So they wrote a patent for this barcode idea, and they received the patent in 1952.
Wow.
And they said, okay, now let's work on this guy. Well, it turned out that while they're waiting for the patent to be to be awarded, I think Woodland needed work, and I think his mom was saying, Norman Joseph, I understand you're trying to create something really big here, but Dad and I really wonder about you going to Grandpa's house and sitting on the beach all summer. You know, we're thinking that this may not be a good way to develop your career.
Probably not.
They were skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
So Norman Joseph Woodland got a job with IBM in 1951 as a mechanical engineer. This was just the year before the patent was awarded. As soon as the patent was awarded, he says, maybe IBM could develop. So he went to IBM and he says, what do you think about this? I got this patent. IBM looked at it. They said, nah, there's nothing in that. They dropped it.
Mm-hmm.
So then he and his buddy sold the patent for $15,000 to Philco. Then Philco worked on it and worked on it, and they couldn't come up with an idea how to use it. So they sold it to RCA, and then RCA worked on it for years and never could come up with it, a way to do it, until 1969. And then in 1969, finally they hit pay dirt and they had a way to use it. And RCA then went to the National Association of Food Chains with this idea, and they actually formed the U.S. Supermarket Ad Hoc Committee on Uniform Grocery Product Code.
Mm-hmm.
And now there were a group of people working on it. Now, here's the rub. The patent expired in 1969. So now anybody could work on the barcode.
Oh, great.
So see, but this was the good news
for Woodland?
Norman Joseph Woodland.
Mm-hmm.
He worked at IBM. So IBM all of a sudden got interested in the barcode. They researched it and discovered one of their employees had the original patent.
Woodland.
So they assigned Norman to work on the project. Isn't that amazing?
That is. They figured out that he was indeed the person.
Yeah. And so they had him. So they assigned him to the group that was going to work mm-hmm. on the project. And then IBM started working on the project. And it turned out then that IBM actually developed the barcode reader before RCA, and they were first to market and first to capitalize on it. So in the end, Woodland did succeed in developing the barcode system, but Unfortunately, he didn't have any patent rights because he sold it for a mere $15,000.
I was going to say, what a shame.
What a shame. Now, the first scanned item was a packet of chewing gum in an Ohio supermarket in 1974. Now, you might ask, why wasn't a practical scanner developed until 1969 when it was patented in 1952?
Why not?
There was no laser until the mid-60s.
There you go.
So there was no scanner.
Mm-hmm.
It took the invention of the low-cost laser to make these scanning devices practical. And so the lasers were developed in the mid-60s. So then by 69, people were, you know, scanning these laser beams. You got these red, the scanners are red. So it's like they're basically helium neon lasers, little helium neon lasers. And those were the first lasers developed. So they're scanning these helium neon lasers, making the scanner. So then by 69, people were making laser scanners. And so then all of a sudden the barcode then patent surfaced. This is a perfect application.
Wow.
So then, so here's a case where the idea preceded the technology that it could make it practical.
Way preceded.
Yeah.
When you think about it, that's fascinating.
So Woodland died December 9th, 2012.
Just recently, in
Edgewood, New Jersey. This is how I discovered the story. I was reading, I was reading about his death, and they talked about his, and I said, well, that's an interesting story. So I went back and kind of researched it out.
Just about to ask you that. Now, that brings it to work, to mind a possible homework assignment for you.
Yes, what is that?
Maybe when you come back, you figure out who developed the QR code, because that's kind of like the next generation of
that's
that,
like
isn't
the,
it?
That's like a two-dimensional two-dimensional code. I'll look at the QR code. That's a very good idea.
Well, that was fascinating. I hope that you all were paying very strict attention to that, right?
Because
you have a chance to win free food from us.
That's
coming up.
That's right.
The pop quiz is next here on Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, 1035 FM HD2. Stand by. The pop quiz and Tech Talk returns right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Technology is constantly changing. An effective IT manager must not only understand the possibilities and limitations of the technology, but also the requirements and constraints of the business world. Enhance your career today with a master's degree from Stratford University School of Computer Information Systems. Classes are offered day, evening, and weekends to match your busy schedule and are taught by experienced faculty members with industry experience. Earn your master's degree in as little as 15 months with an accelerated program in software engineering, information systems, information assurance, or telecommunications. Learn more about earning your master's degree from Stratford University at stratford.edu or call 1-800-444-0804. Disclose statements available at stratford.edu/disclosures. Stratford University, 1-800-444-0804.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now, here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Yes, this is a classroom of the airways for
Indeed.
Those of you that have been around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
It took us a while to actually learn that, but now we have.
Well, it took me a while to learn it.
It took my co-host a while to learn. He thought it was, Jim thought it was a radio show, but actually it's a disguised radio show. It's actually a classroom of the airways. Earlier in the show, we were talking about Norman Joseph Woodland, the co-inventor of the barcode used for tracking inventory. When he finally developed it for IBM. After he developed for IBM, what was the first scanned item that was scanned in an Ohio supermarket in 1974. Now, if you get the correct answer to that pop quiz question, you'll win two tickets to fine dine at the Escoffier Dining Room or the Karim Dining Room in Woodbridge or Falls Church, Virginia. And all you have to do is contact us via some standard methods.
Well, that's right. And that will be using the POTS line, the telephone. Yes. If you're calling from west of Atlantic City, New Jersey, it's 877-936-9333. If you're calling from east of Edgewater, New Jersey, it's 877-936-9333. The wild card line is 877-936-9333. And for the slightly more tech savvy, Doc.
That's right. Or if you are in Anchorage, Alaska, you can call us using Skype. And you simply log on to Skype, connect with Tech Talk Radio 1. Make a phone call to that account, and that will be forwarded to the studio free of charge, and you can call us there from any place in the world.
Right.
While we were at break, William Barrett posted a note on our Facebook page. He said, "You did not mention Magic Jack as a voiceover IP option. My sister ported her landline to Magic Jack for $20 a year and use it whenever there's an electric outlet and Wi-Fi available to plug in a standard phone. Even better, she downloaded an app on her iPad and uses it anywhere Wi-Fi is available. It has an answering machine, caller ID, etc. The initial investment was $40 for hardware in the first year of service and $9.95 to port the number. She currently uses it while in Mexico and can receive and place calls anywhere in the U.S. William, thanks for that input. That is another option, Magic Jack, that I failed to mention.
Okay.
Let's talk about the FTC settles with Google.
Okay.
This is a short segment. The FTC, Federal Trade Commission, of course, has been after Google for antitrust violations. Actually, the European Union is after them, too. They say they're using some unfair practices in search engine methods, and they're also doing some unfair things relating to mobile phone patents. So the FTC has been investigating them for nearly 2 years into those business practices, and Google emerged essentially unscathed. The FTC decided unanimously that Google was not violating any antitrust laws when it comes to search results. For Google, this is a major victory. Google competitors, especially Microsoft, are livid because they think Google is stacking the deck on their search results for their people that are paying them. And in fact, Google was not doing that, according to the FTC. And so that was a huge win for Google because the search engine algorithm is sort of core to Google's business. Now, Google will have to license some of its patents that it acquired from Motorola more liberally. The FTC found that Google's use of some of the patents it acquired from Motorola to be anti-competitive. Google can no longer file injunctions against competitors that make use of those patents, which are needed for complying with technical standards. See, many times they'll create technical standards in a standards group, and then that standard has been patented. And so people have to comply to the standard, in order to be compatible, and then they violate the patent. And what FTC is saying, look, if people are complying to something because of a technical standards group, you must license that technology to them in a reasonable way. Google agreed to follow to allow competitors to access the patents on a fair and reasonable and non-discriminatory basis. However, the European Union has said they don't care what the FTC says. They're still going after Google. So the next battleground is going to be Europe.
Excellent.
So that's it. So
you'll be happy to know that the first show out of the gate here in the new year, we have full phone lines, and we've got somebody new on the phone. Let's go to Missy, who is calling us from Silver Spring, Maryland. Missy, good morning and welcome to the program. How are you?
Good morning. How are you, Doctor? How are you doing?
Good morning.
Good morning. Doctor, go ahead and ask the question.
Yeah, Norman. Earlier in the show, we talked about Norman Joseph Woodward, the co-inventor of the barcode. What was the first item that was scanned in an Ohio supermarket in 1974 using that barcode?
A pack of chewing gum.
That is correct.
That is the correct answer. Dr. Schurz, tell her what she's won.
You'll win two tickets to fine dining at the Escoffier Dining Room and the Karim Dining Room. Just simply stay on the line and leave your name, address, and email address with Andrew, and we'll get the tickets out to you next week.
That is correct. Missy, thank you for calling. You're a first-time caller. Have you been listening to us for long?
Yes, for a long time. I love your show. Thank you so much. I always listen before I go to the gym.
Great.
Oh, very
well, thanks,
good.
Melissa. Thanks, Missy, for listening. Hang on. I'm going to turn you over now to Dr. Andrew Mitchell, who is our adjunct professor for telecom services and prize distribution.
Yes.
So he will take care of things from this point forward. Doc, let's take a break here. And you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, 1035 FM HD2. More Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Budget analyst, a vice president of sales. These are today's business leaders, and a degree from Stratford University's Tysons Corner or Woodbridge campus offers you a powerful path to navigate the corporate world. The School of Business Administration at Stratford University offers both bachelor's and master's degree programs for a real-world education. In fact, many of today's Stratford business grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. An executive chef at a trendy restaurant, a hotel general manager at a prestigious resort. These are the high-profile positions in the culinary arts and hospitality management industry. Get working towards your bachelor's or master's degree at Stratford University's Tysons Corner or Woodbridge campus. In fact, many of today's Stratford culinary arts and hospitality grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. The internet was born 30 years ago. 30 years ago this week, the modern internet became operational as the U.S. military flipped the switch on TCP/IP. The deadline was January 1st, 1983. I previously said 82. I forgot this is 2013. I just forgot.
You're still writing checks.
I'm still writing checks, yeah. So it was January 1st, 1982. After this, any of the Advanced Research Project Agencies networks, the ARPANET, which had 400 hosts at the time, that were still using existing host-to-host network control protocol, were to be cut off. And you see, they love that NCP, that network control protocol, and there were a few laggards that didn't want to switch over because they didn't believe in TCP/IP. And on this date, they just cut them off. The move to packet switching with TCP/IP was simultaneously and coordinated with the community in the years before 1983. More than 15 government and university institutions from NASA Ames to Harvard University used NCP on the ARPANET. With so many users, there was plenty of disagreement. The deadline was just ultimately set, and everybody had to switch over to it. TCP/IP was the co-creation, of course, Vint Cerf and Robert Kahn, who published their paper on a protocol for network interconnections in 1974. Let me give an aside,
okay,
because I want to explain what this TCPI was all about. When they had the ARPANET, they, of course, had different ways where the nodes were connected. In the U.S., they were connected over basically, in the beginning, just dial-up phone lines, just telecom lines. In Hawaii, they had an AlohaNet that was basically a packet-switched transmission over the airways. And so it was a different type of physical layer communicating the data. And the problem was you had all of these different networks that had different physical layers. And so at the physical communication layer, they were all different. And yet you want to take all of these networks and let them all talk with each other. So you had to go to one layer higher above what they called the data link layer, which was setting a link in each of these individual connections, and actually have software that could talk to all of the physical layers, no matter what they were. And so they took all of the networks, and they allowed them to talk to each other, so it became an inter-network. And that's where the name Internet came from.
Huh.
So it was an inter-network, and TCP/IP was the protocol that worked on top of the data link layer and the physical layer. And if you're familiar with the network model, IP is layer 3 and TCP is layer 4. So you've got the physical layer is layer 1, the data link layer, which connects the nodes, is layer 2. IP is layer 3 and TCP is layer 4. And so you put TCP IP on top of the networks and they started running it. And that became the beginning of the internet as we know it today. And that was basically TCP IP version 4. And now we're switching over to, they never did come out with version 5, and we're switching over now to version 6, probably this year and the next year. They're trying to push everybody to IPv6 right now. Vint Cerf, who was the ARPANET, was a wider network sponsored by the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, and it went live in 1969 whilst Cerf had been an ARPANET scientist at Stanford University. The military became interested in the common protocol as different networks and systems using different protocols began to hook to the internet and find they couldn't talk to each other like AlohaNet and other things. Cerf, who today is vice president and chief internet evangelist at Google, announced the 30th anniversary of the TCPI switchover as an official Google blog titled Marking the Birth of the Modern Day Internet. When the day came, it's fair to say that emotion, according to Vince, that served, that the main emotion of the day was relief, especially among those systems administrators who were racing against the clock. There was no grand celebration. The only visible mementos, according to Vince Cerf, were these badges that said, "I survived the TCP/IP switchover." On that day, the operational internet was born, and TCP/IP went on to be embraced as the international standard that now underpins the entire internet. But what happened there was further problems that occurred. Initially they had 400 nodes, but once they began to allow people to hook into the thing, and people said, wow, this thing really works. By 1986, there were 28,000 nodes on the ARPANET. Went from 400 to 28,000, and what happened was the ARPANET was just crushing under that bandwidth load, and that congestion speed started dropping from 32 kilobits per second, which was the sort of the connection. These were basically dial-up connections back then, and they dropped down to 40 bits per second across relatively small distances because they just couldn't handle all of that bandwidth. This was before the World Wide Web, and they were just sending text messages and things. Van Jacobsen spotted this slowdown between his lab and Lawrence Berkeley National Lab in the University of California at Berkeley, just 400 yards away, and he devised a congestion avoidance algorithm that lowered the computer's network transfer speed and settled on a stable but slower connection. And so whenever you had a lot of connection on the system, instead of all the nodes just firing out and creating more and more collisions, he slowed everybody down. And then it became more efficient, and that allowed the internet to scale. The algorithm allowed TCP/IP to process more requests in a conservative fashion. The fix was first applied to a patch, client-side patch to PCs by sysadmins, and then incorporated into the TCP/IP protocol stack. Jacobsen went on to author the congestion avoidance and control paper in 1988. While the internet expanded very quickly to more than 1 billion nodes. So it's a great story about how a decentralized system was designed to be scalable and growable, and it truly has transformed the world.
Gotcha. Let's keep it here, Doc. You got a lot of stuff to cover.
Okay, let's talk about the idea of the week.
Yeah.
A gravity-powered light. Now, many people in developing countries don't have the luxury of electric grids. They have to rely on kerosene lamps to brighten the night. You go to a lot of like these, the tribal areas in Africa, the tribal areas in many countries, there's no electricity, and all they have is kerosene. And so people have a kerosene lamp in their tent. And the kerosene costs money, first of all.
Sure.
Secondly, and probably more damaging, is that breathing the fumes of kerosene is dangerous. And so people have all kinds of medical problems because they're breathing kerosene fumes at night.
And plus the obvious fire hazard.
Plus the fire, people get hurt. And so, and of course, the batteries are too expensive. There's no electricity. The generators are too difficult to get. And so they've developed a new light called the gravity light, which is powered by gravity, which is probably a superior solution. Now, this is what happens. You take this light. It's an LED light. and you have a belt that goes in one slot of the light and out the other. You hang the light up, and on one side of the belt, you attach a bag of sand. The bag of sand pulls the belt down, and it turns a little tiny generator that turns on the light. So if you hang the light at ceiling height, and you raise the bag of sand up to ceiling height, it lasts 30 minutes for the bag of sand to come down to the ground, and you simply take and rewind it. And actually what you do is there's a hook at each end of the string. You simply move the bag to the other side and pull it back, and then you've got another 30 minutes of light. So there's no battery, there's no kerosene, you've got 30 minutes of light of this LED light. I mean, it is actually, could be it could be transformational for these developing countries. They don't have to buy kerosene, and the thing just lasts forever. And you can actually just, you know, raise that bag of sand up in like 10 seconds, and you've got 30 minutes of light. So this is actually quite transformational, this idea. Now, in order for it to be effective, though, they need to be able to sell these at about $5 per light.
Sure.
Now, right now the cost of the light is around $100.
Mm-hmm.
But now, where do they get $5? It turns out that $5 is about what how much it, kerosene would cost for 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can buy a light for $5, in 3 months, you've got your investment paid off because you've saved now 3 months worth of kerosene. And then after the first 3 month period, it's just it's gravy.
It's cake.
So what they've done, they've gone to a crowdsourced funding method in order to further develop this. And it's called Indiegogo. And they've gone on Indiegogo, and they've already raised $320,000 for further development. So what you do on Indiegogo, you can go to Indiegogo, and it's I've got the link to it. It's indiegogo.com/project/28-2006. The link will be on the Stratford, on the Tech Talk Online website. You can go to Indiegogo. You can contribute $50, and when they develop the light, they'll send you a light, and then they'll send one additional light to some developing country.
Wow, that's a great idea.
And so they've actually raised, their goal was to raise $55,000. They've raised $320,000. And they believe that with this research money, they can bring the cost of the light down to $5 because they, you know, now they have the proof of concept. Now it's a matter of optimizing it, scaling it, and that sort of thing. I think this is transformational. I particularly like this way of raising money.
Yeah.
To Indiegogo.com.
Or we could just take all the hand crank radios we bought with the lights in them when the world was going to end on January 1st, 2000. We could send them over too.
That's right. This is a, and this is a lot better than, hand crank.
And they could listen to Tech Talk too.
That's right. We need a gravity powered radio.
There you go.
A gravity powered radio.
Except this isn't a radio show.
Oh, yeah. Gravity powered. That's right. But then we need an internet connection. That's another.
Oh,
there are all
never
kinds
mind.
Of other
okay.
issues. Okay. The top jobs for 2013.
Mm-hmm.
These top professions are among the best jobs that require a bachelor's degree for 2013, according to a new study put out by Career Builders and Economic Modeling Specialist International. The study uses EMSI's rich labor market database and pulls from over 90 national and state employment resources. The number one job, software developer. There are 70,000 jobs there, and that grew 7%. The number two job, accountants and auditors. The number three job, market research analyst. Fourth job, computer systems analyst. Five, human resource training and labor relations. Six, network and computer systems administrator. Seven, sales rep, especially wholesale and manufacturing. Number eight, information security analysts, web developers, and computer architects. Nine, mechanical engineers. 10, industrial engineers. 11, computer programmers. 12, financial analysts, 13, public relations specialists, 14, logisticians, and 15, database administrators. The significant thing is out of those top 15 jobs, six of them are in IT.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that goes anywhere from databases to security to networks to software development. So that's a pretty good idea. Well, listen, we love the show. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu and make certain to check us out at stratford.edu and let them know that you heard about the programs on Tech Talk.
That's right. And if you like this show, you can hear it again today at 4 o'clock here on Federal News Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
And, of course, Federal News Radio, we also have the forecast for you right now. It's going to be sunny today with a high in close to 40 degrees, light northwest winds. For tonight, there's a chance of snow in the overnight, a very slight chance, little or no accumulation. Right outside our studios in northwest D.C., lots of sun now, 38 degrees at 10 o'clock.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements.